Dorfel's trail was the word on the street. The mixed smells of the slaughterhouse filled Angua's nostrils. The journey zigzagged, but with a certain directional tendency. It was as if the golem had laid a ruler across the town and taken every road and alley that went in the right direction. She came to a short, blind alley. There were some warehouse gates at the end. She sniffed. There were plenty of other smells, too. Dough, paint, grease, pine resin. Sharp, loud, fresh scents. She sniffed again. Cloth? Wool? There was a confusion of footprints in the dirt, large footprints. The small part of Angua that always walked on two legs saw that the footprints coming out were on top of the footprints going in. She snuffled around. Up to 12 creatures, each with their own very distinctive smell, the smell of merchandise rather than living creatures, had all very recently gone down the stairwell, and all 12 had come back up. She went down the steps and was met by an impenetrable barrier, a door. Paws were no good at doorknobs. She peered over the top of the steps. There was no one around, only the fog hung between the buildings. She concentrated and changed, leaned against the wall for a moment until the world stopped spinning, and tried the door. There was a large cellar beyond. Even with a werewolf's eyesight, there wasn't much to see. She had to stay human. She thought better when she was human. Unfortunately, here and now, as a human, the thought occupying her mind in no small measure was that she was naked. Anyone finding a naked woman in their cellar would be bound to ask questions. They might not even bother with questions, even ones like, please. Angua could certainly deal with that situation, but she preferred not to have to. It was so difficult explaining away the shape of the wounds. No time to waste, then. The walls were covered in writing. Big letters, small letters, but all in that neat script which the golems used. There were phrases in chalk and paint and charcoal, and in some cases simply cut into the stone itself. They reached from floor to ceiling, criss-crossing one another, over and over again, so often that it was almost impossible to make out what any of them were meant to say. Here and there a word or two stood out in the jumble of letters. "Shalt not. What he does is not. Rage at the Creator. Woe unto the masterless. Words in the clay of our let my bring us to free." The dust in the middle of the floor was scuffed, as if a number of people had been milling around. She crouched down and rubbed the dirt, occasionally sniffing her finger. Smells. They were industrial smells. She hardly needed special senses to detect them. A golem didn't smell of anything except clay, and whatever it was working with at the time. And something rolled under her fingers. It was a length of wood only a couple of inches long. A matchstick without a head. A few minutes' investigation found another 10 lying here and there as if they'd been idly dropped. There was also half a stick, tossed away some distance from the others. Her night vision was fading, but sense of smell lasted much longer. Smells were strong on the sticks, the same cocktail of odours that had trailed into this damp room. But the slaughterhouse smell she'd come to associate with Dorfel was on only the broken piece. She sat back on her haunches and looked at the little heap of wood. 12 people. 12 people in messy jobs had come here. They hadn't stayed long. They'd had a discussion, the writing on the wall. They'd done something involving 11 matches, just the wooden part. They hadn't been dipped to get the head. Maybe the pine-smelling golem worked in a match factory. Plus one broken match. Then they'd all left and gone their separate ways. Dorfel's way had taken him straight to the main watch-house to give himself up. Why? She sniffed at the piece of broken match again. There was no doubt about the cocktail of blood and meat smells. Dorfel had given himself up for murder. She stared at the writing on the wall and shivered.
"Cheers, Fred," said Nobby, raising his pint. "We can put the money back in the tea club tomorrow. No one'll miss it," said Sergeant Colon. "Anyway, this comes under the heading of an emergency."
Corporal Nobbs looked despondently into his glass. People often did this in the Mended Drum, when the immediate thirst had been slaked, and for the first time they could take a good look at what they were drinking.
"What am I going to do?" he moaned. "If you're a nob, you've got to wear coronets and long robes and that. Got to cost a mint, that kind of stuff. And there's stuff you've got to do." He took another long swig. "It's called Noblesse Oblige. "Nobbly yes obligay," corrected Colon. "Yeah, means you got to keep your end up in society, giving money to charities, being kind to the poor, passing your old clothes to your gardener when there's still some good wear left in them. I know about that. My uncle was butler to old Lady Salachi."
"Ain't got a gardener," said Nobby gloomily. "Ain't got a garden. Ain't got any old clothes except what I'm wearing." He took another swig.
"She gave her old clothes to the gardener, did she?"
Colon nodded.
"Yeah. We were always a bit puzzled about that gardener."
He caught the barman's eye. "Two more pints of Winkles, Ron?" He glanced at Nobby. His old friend looked more dejected than he'd ever seen him. "I'd have to see this thing through together. Better make that two for Nobby, too," he added.
"Cheers, Fred."
Sergeant Colon's eyebrows raised as one pint was emptied almost in one go. Nobby put the mug down a little unsteadily.
"Wouldn't be so bad if there was a pot of cash," Nobby said, picking up the other mug. "I thought you couldn't be a nob without being a rich bugger. I thought they gave you a big wad with one hand and banged the crown on your head with the other. Don't make sense, being nobby and poor. It's worst of both worlds."
He drained the mug and banged it down.
"Common and rich. Yeah, that I could help."
The barman leaned over to Sergeant Colon. "What's up with the corporal? He's a half-pint man. That's 8 pints he's had." Fred Colon leaned closer and spoke out of the corner of his mouth.
"Keep it to yourself, Ron, but it's because he's a peer."
"Is that a fact?
I'll go and put down some fresh sawdust."
In the watch-house, Sam Vimes prodded the matches. He didn't ask Angua if she was sure. Angua could smell if it was Wednesday.
"So, who were the others?" he said. "Other golems?"
"It's hard to tell from the tracks," said Angua, "but I think so. I'd have followed them, but I thought I ought to come right back here."
"What makes you think they were golems?"
"The footprints. And golems have no smell," she said. "They pick up the smells associated with whatever they're doing. That's all they smell of."
She thought of the wall of words.
"And they had a long debate," she said. "A golem argument. In writing. It got pretty heated, I think."
She thought about the wall again. "Some of them got quite emphatic," she added, remembering the size of some of the lettering. "If they were human, they'd have been shouting." Vimes stared gloomily at the matches laid out before him, 11 bits of wood and a 12th broken in two. "You didn't need to be any kind of genius to see what had been going on."
"They drew lots," he said, "and Dorful lost."
He sighed.
"This is getting worse," he said. "Does anyone know how many golems there are in the city?"
"No," said Carrot. "Hard to find out. No one's made any for centuries, but they don't wear out."
"No one makes them. It's banned, sir. The priests are pretty hot on that, sir. They say it's making life, and that's something only gods are supposed to do. But they put up with the ones that are still around because, well, they're so useful. Some are walled up or in treadmills or at the bottom of shafts, doing messy tasks, you know, in places where it's dangerous to go. They do all the really mucky jobs. I suppose there could be hundreds."
"Hundreds," said Vimes.
"And now they meet secretly and make plots. Good grief.
Right. We ought to destroy the lot of them."
"Why?" "You like the idea of them having secrets? I mean, good grief, trolls and dwarfs are fine. Even the undead are alive in a way, even if it is a bloody awful way."
Vimes caught Angua's eye and went on,
"for the most part. But these things, they're just things that do work. It's like having a bunch of shovels meeting for a chat."
There was something else, sir," said Angua slowly.
"In the cellar?"
"Yes, but it's hard to explain. It was a feeling."
Vimes shrugged non-committally. He'd learned not to scoff at Angua's feelings. She always knew where Carrot was, for one thing. If she were in the watch-house, you could tell if he were coming up the street by the way she turned to look at the door. "Yes?"
"Like deep grief, sir. Terrible, terrible sadness."
Vimes nodded and pinched the bridge of his nose. It seemed to have been a long day, and it was far from over yet. He really, really needed a drink. The world was distorted enough as it was. When you saw it through the bottom of a glass, it all came back into focus.
"Have you had anything to eat today, sir?" said Angua.
"I had a bit of breakfast," muttered Vimes.
"You know that word Sergeant Colon uses?"
"What, manky?"
"That's how you look. If you're staying here, at least let's have some coffee and send out for Figgins."
Vimes hesitated at that. He'd always imagined that manky was how your mouth felt after 3 days on a regurgitated diet. It was horrible to think that you could look like that. Angua reached for the old coffee tin that represented the watch's tea kitty. It was surprisingly easy to lift.
"Hey, there should be at least $25 in here," she said. "Nobby collected it only yesterday."
She turned the tin upside down. A very small dog end dropped out.
"Not even an IOU," said Carrot, despondently. "An IOU? This is Nobby we're talking about." "Oh, of course."
It had gone very quiet in the mended drum. Happy hour had been passed with no more than a minor fight. Now everyone was watching unhappy hour. There was a forest of mugs in front of Nobby.
I mean, what's it worth when all's said and done?" he said.
"You could flog it," said Ron.
"Good point," said Sergeant Colon. "There's plenty of rich folks who'd give a sack of cash for a title. I mean, folks that's already got the big house and that. They'd give anything to be as Nobby as you, Nobby."
The ninth pint stopped halfway to Nobby's lips.
"Could be worth thousands of dollars," said Ron encouragingly.
"At the very least," said Colon. "They'd fight over it."
"You play your cards right, and you could retire on something like that," said Ron.
The mug remained stationary. Various expressions fought their way around the lumps and excrescences of Nobby's face, suggesting the terrible battle within.
"Oh, they would they?" he said at last.
Sergeant Colon tilted unsteadily away. There was an edge in Nobby's voice he hadn't heard before.
"Then you could be rich and common, just like you said," said Ron, who didn't have quite the same eye for mental weather changes. "Posh folks would be falling over themselves for it."
"Sell my birthright for a spot of massage? Is that it?"
said Nobby.
"It's a pot of message," said Sergeant Colon.
"It's a mess of pottage," said a bystander, anxious not to break the flow.
"Ha, ha! Well, I'll tell you," said Nobby, swaying. "There's some things that can't be sold, eh? Eh? Who steals my purse steals the trash, right?"
"Yeah, it's the trashiest looking purse I ever saw," said a voice.
"What is a mess of pottage, anyway? 'Cause what good does a lot of money do me, eh?"
The clientele looked puzzled. This seemed to be a question on the lines of, "Alcohol, is it nice?" or, "Hard work, do you want to do it?"
"What's messy about it, then?" "Well," said a brave soul uncertainly, "you could use it to buy a big house, lots of grub and drink and women and that." "That's what it takes to make a man happy, is it?"
said Nobby, glassy-eyed. His fellow drinkers just stared. This was a metaphysical maze.
"Well, I'll tell you," said Nobby, the swaying now so regular that he looked like an inverted pendulum. "All that stuff's nothing, nothing, I tell you, compared to pride in a man's linen-yin-yin-yin-yidge."
"Linen-yin-yin-yidge," said Sergeant Colon.
"Ancestors and that," said Nobby. "Means I've got ancestors and that, which is more than you lot have got."
Sergeant Colon choked on his pint. "Everyone's got ancestors," said the barman calmly. "Otherwise, they wouldn't be here." Nobby gave him a glassy stare and tried unsuccessfully to focus.
"Right," he said eventually. "Right. Only I've got more of them, d'ye see? The blood of bloody kings is in these veins, am I right?"
"Temporarily," said a voice. There was laughter, but it had an anticipatory ring to it that Colon had learned to respect and fear. It reminded him of two things. One, he had got only 6 weeks to retirement, and two, it had been quite a long time since he'd been to the lavatory. Nobby delved into his pocket and pulled out a battered scroll.
"You see this?"
he said, unrolling it with difficulty in the bar.
"You see it? I've got a right to arm bears, me. See here, it says Earl, right? That's me. You could have my head up over the door."
"Could be,"
said the barman, eyeing the crowd.
"I mean, you could change the name of this place, call it the Earl of Onk, and I'd come in and drink here, regular. What do you say?"
said Nobby.
News gets around an Earl drinks here, business will go right up. And I wouldn't charge you a penny. How about it? People say, that's a high-class pub, is that? Lord de Nobbs drinks there. That's a place with a bit of tone.
Someone grabbed Nobby by the throat. Colin didn't recognise the grabber. He was just one of the scarred, ill-shaven regulars whose function it was, around this time of an evening, to start opening bottles with his teeth, or if the evening was going really well, with someone else's teeth.
"So, we ain't good enough for you, is that what you're saying?"
the man demanded. Nobby waved his scroll. His mouth opened to frame words like, Sergeant Colin just knew, "Unhand me, you low-born oaf." With tremendous presence of mind and absence of any kind of common sense, Sergeant Colin said, "His lordship wants everybody to have a drink with him." Compared to the mended drum, the bucket in Gleam Street was an oasis of frigid calm. The Watch had adopted it as their own, as a silent temple to the art of getting drunk. It wasn't that it sold particularly good beer, because it didn't, but it did serve it quickly and quietly, and gave credit. It was one place where watchmen didn't have to see things or be disturbed. No one could sink alcohol in silence, like a watchman who'd just come off duty after 8 hours on the street. It was as much protection as his helmet and breastplate. The world didn't hurt so much. And Mr. Cheese, the owner, was a good listener. He listened to things like, make that a double and keep them coming. He also said the right things, like, credit, certainly, officer. Watchmen paid their tab or got a lecture from Captain Carrot. Vimes sat gloomily behind a glass of lemonade. He wanted one drink and understood precisely why he wasn't going to have one. One drink ended up arriving in a dozen glasses. But knowing this didn't make it any better. Most of the day shift were in here now, plus one or two men who were on their day off. Scummy as the place was, he liked it here. With the buzz of other people around him, he didn't seem to get in the way of his own thoughts. One reason that Mr. Cheese had allowed his pub to become practically the city's fifth watchhouse was the protection this offered. Watchmen were quiet drinkers on the whole. They just went from vertical to horizontal with the minimum amount of fuss, without starting any major fights, and without damaging the fixtures overmuch. And no one ever tried to rob him. Watchmen got really intense about having their drinking disturbed. And he was therefore surprised when the door was flung open and three men rushed in, flourishing crossbows.
"Don't nobody move, anyone moves, and they're dead."
The robbers stopped at the bar. To their own surprise, their arrival didn't seem to have caused much of a stir.
"Oh, for heaven's sake, will someone shut that door?" growled Vimes.
A watchman near the door did so.
"And bolt it," Vimes added.
The three thieves looked around. As their eyes grew accustomed to the gloom, they received a general impression of armorality, with strong overtones of helmetness. But none of it was moving, it was all watching them.
"You boys new in town?"
said Mr. Cheese, buffing a glass. The boldest of the three waved his bow under the barman's nose.
"All the money, right now," he screamed. "Otherwise," he said to the room in general, "you've got a dead barman."
"Plenty of other bars in town, boyo," said a voice.
Mr. Cheese didn't look up from the glass he was polishing.
"I know that was you, Constable Thighbiter," he said calmly. "There's $2.30 on your slate. Thank you very much."
The thieves drew closer together. Bars shouldn't act like this, and they fancied they could hear the faint sliding noises of assorted weapons being drawn from various sheaths.
"Haven't I seen you before?" said Carrot.
"Oh, gods, it's him," moaned one of the men, "the bread thrower."
"I thought Mr. Ironcrust was taking you to the Thieves' Guild," Carrot went on.
"There was a bit of an argument about taxes."
"Don't tell him," Carrot tapped his head. "The tax forms," he said. "I expect Mr. Ironcrust is worried I've forgotten about them."
The thieves were now so close together, they looked like a fat, six-armed man with a very large bill for hats.
"Watchmen aren't allowed to kill people, right?" said one of them.
"Not while we're on duty," said Vimes.
The boldest of the three moved suddenly, grabbed Angua, and pulled her upright.
"We walk out of here, unharmed, or the girl gets it, all right," he snarled.
Someone sniggered.
"I hope you're not going to kill anyone," said Carrot.
"That's up to us."
"Sorry? Was I talking to you?" said Carrot.
"Don't worry, I'll be fine," said Angua.
She looked around to make sure Cheery wasn't there, and then sighed.
"Come on, gentlemen, let's get it over with."
"Don't play with your food," said a voice from the crowd.
There were one or two giggles until Carrot turned in his seat, whereupon everyone was suddenly intensely interested in their drinks.
"It's okay," said Angua, quietly.
Aware that something was out of kilter, but not quite sure what it was, the thieves edged back to the door. No one moved as they unbolted it, and still holding Angua, stepped out into the fog, shutting the door behind them.
"Hadn't we better help?"
said a constable, who was new to the watch.
"They don't deserve help," said Vimes.
There was a clank of armour, and then a long, deep growl right outside in the street, and a scream. And then another scream, and a third scream, modulated with, "No, no, 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 ah, ah, ah!" Something heavy hit the door. Vimes turned back to Carrot.
"You and Constable Angua," he said, "you, get along all right?"
"Fine, sir," said Carrot.
"Some people might think that, there might be, problems."
There was a thud, and then a faint, bubbling noise.
"We work around them, sir," said Carrot, raising his voice slightly.
"I heard that her father's not very happy about her working here."
"They don't have much law up in Uberwald, sir. They think it's for weak societies. The Baron's not a very civic-minded man."
"He's pretty bloodthirsty, from what I've heard."
"She wants to stay in the watch, sir. She likes meeting people."
From outside came another gurgle, fingernails scrabbled at a window pane. Then their owner disappeared abruptly from view.
"Well, it's not for me to judge," said Vimes.
"No, sir."
After a few moments of silence, the door opened slowly. Angua walked in, adjusting her clothes, and sat down. All the watchmen in the room suddenly took a second course of advanced beer study.
Carrot began. "Flesh wounds," said Angua, "but one of them did shoot one of the others in the leg by accident."
"I think you'd better put it in your report as self-inflicted wounds while resisting arrest," said Vimes.
"Yes, sir," said Angua.
"Not all of them," said Carrot. "They tried to rob our bar and take a Angua hostage," said Vimes.
"Oh, I see what you mean, sir," said Carrot. "Self-inflicted." "Yes, of course."
It had gone quiet in the mended drum. This was because it is usually very hard to be both loud and unconscious. Sergeant Colan was impressed at his own cleverness. Throwing a punch could stop a fight, of course, but in this case it had a quarter of rum, gin, and 16 chopped lemons floating in it. Some people were still upright, however. They were the serious drinkers who drank as if there was no tomorrow and rather hoped this would be the case. Fred Colon had reached the convivial drunk stage. He turned to the man beside him.
"It's good here, isn't it?" he managed.
"What am I going to tell me wife? That's what I want to know," moaned the man.
"Dunno, see, you've been working late," said Colan, "and suck a peppermint before you goes home, that usually works."
"Working late, huh? I've been given the sack, me. A craftsman, 15 years at Spadger and Williams, right? And then they go bust because of Carrie undercutting them, and I get a job at Carrie's and bang, I'm out of a job there too. Surplus to requirements. Bloody golems, forcing real people out of a job. What they want to work for, they got no mouth to feed, eh? But the damn thing goes at it so fast you can't see its bloody arms moving."
"Shame.
Smash him up, that's what I say. I mean, we had a golem at S&W's, but old Schlob just used to plod along, you know, not buzz away like a blue-arse fly. You want to watch it, mate. They'll have your job next."
"Stoneface wouldn't stand for it," said Colan, undulating gently.
"Any chance of a job with you lot, then?"
"Dunno," said Colan.
The man seemed to have become two men.
"What's it you do?"
"I'm a wick dipper and end teaser, mate," they said.
"I can see that's a useful trade."
"Here you go, Fred," said the barman, tapping him on the shoulder and putting a piece of paper in front of him. Colan watched with interest as figures danced back and forth. He tried to focus on the one at the bottom, but it was too big to take in.
"What's this, then?"
"His Imperial Lordship's bar bill," said the barman.
"Don't be daft. No one can drink that much. I'm not paying."
"I'm including breakages, mind you."
"Yeah, like what?"
The barman pulled a heavy hickory stick from its hiding place under the bar. "Arms, legs, suit yourself," he said.
"Oh, come on, Ron. You've known me for years."
"Yes, Fred, you've always been a good customer, so what I'll do is I'll let you shut your eyes first."
"But that's all the money I've got."
The barman grinned. "Lucky one for you, eh?" Cheery Little Bottom leaned against the corridor wall outside her privy and wheezed. It was something alchemists learned to do early in their career. As her tutors had said, there were two signs of a good alchemist, the athletic and the intellectual. A good alchemist of the first sort was someone who could leap over the bench and be on the far side of a safely thick wall in 3 seconds, and a good alchemist of the second sort was someone who knew exactly when to do this. The equipment didn't help. She scrounged what she could from the guild, but a real alchemical laboratory should be full of the kind of glassware that looked as if it were produced during the Guild of Glassblowers' all-comers hiccuping contest. A proper alchemist did not have to run tests, using as her beaker a mug with a picture of a teddy bear on it, which Corporal Nobbs was probably going to be very upset about when he found it missing. When she judged that the fumes had cleared, she ventured back into her tiny room. That was another thing. Her books on alchemy were marvellous objects, every page a work of the engraver's art, but they nowhere contained instructions like, "Be sure to open a window." They did have instructions like, "Add aqua quiemis to the zinc until rising gas use vigorously evolved," but never added, "Don't do this at home," or even, "And say fare thee well to thy eyebrows." Anyway, the glassware remained innocent of the brown-black sheen that, according to the compound of alchemy, would indicate arsenic in the sample. She'd tried every type of food and drink she could find in the palace pantries, and pressed into service every bottle and jar she could discover in the watchhouse. She tried one more time with what said on the packet it was sample 2. Looked like a smear of cheese. Cheese? The various fumes thronging around her head were making her slow. She must have taken some cheese samples. She was pretty sure sample 17 had been some Lancre blue vein, which had reacted vigorously with the acid, blown a small hole in the ceiling, and covered half the workbench with a dark green substance that was setting like tar. She tested this one anyway. A few minutes later she was scrabbling furiously through her notebook. The first sample she'd taken from the pantry, one portion of duck pate, was down here as sample 3. What about samples 1 and 2? No, sample 1 had been the white clay from Misbegot Bridge, so what had been 2? She found it. But that couldn't be right. She looked up at the glass tube. Metallic arsenic grinned back at her. She'd retained a bit of the sample. She could test again, but perhaps it would be better to tell someone. She hurried along to the main office where a troll was on duty. "Where's Commander Vimes?" The troll grinned.
"In the gleam, Little Bottom."
"Thank you."
The troll turned back to address a worried-looking monk in a brown cassock. "And?" he said.
"Best if he tells it himself," said the monk. "I only work on the next bench."
He put a small jar of dust on the desk. It had a bow tie around it.
"I want to complain most emphatically," said the dust in a shrill little voice. "I was working there only 5 minutes, and then splash. It's going to take days to get back into shape."
"Working where?" said the troll.
"None such ecclesiastical supplies," said the worried monk helpfully.
"Holy water section," said the vampire.